Turn tonight to Acts chapter 2, if you would, please. Acts chapter 2, and we're going to begin reading in verse 41 and read to the end of the chapter. That is where we'll begin this evening. Then they that gladly received his word were baptized, and the same day there were added unto them about 3,000 souls. And they continued steadfastly in the apostles' doctrine and fellowship, and in breaking of bread and in prayers. And fear came upon every soul, and many wonders and signs were done by the apostles. And all that believed were together, and had all things common, and sold their possessions and goods, and parted them to all men, as every man had need. And they, continuing daily with one accord in the temple, and breaking bread from house to house, did eat their meat with gladness and singleness of heart, praising God, and having favor with all the people, and the Lord added to the church daily such as should be saved. And let's pray. Lord God, I pray your help upon us as 21st century American Christians to think biblically about all that we do, about the world that surrounds us, the nature that we enjoy, but especially the way that we worship you. And I pray that you would help us this evening. In Jesus' name, amen. So we are taking some time talking about the subject matter of the human conscience and the way that it interacts with God. It has been defined in a variety of ways. I think my favorite is one of the Puritans called the human conscience, the soul reflecting upon itself. And we have these conversations with ourselves about things that are right and things that are wrong and things that are questionable and things that are new. And I have begun by focusing upon the way public things, or the better word, I guess, would be corporate things, impact our conscience. The way that, not the individual things, I mean, there's a place for that, you know. I mean, you know, some of the old, you know, what should I wear? Where can I go? What entertainments can I have? What kind of music? And we'll spend some time on that. I don't think there's any way to answer all of those to everybody's satisfaction, but without, you know, miring down. But I've been concerned with the things that we do in church and the way that these things impact us. A couple of weeks ago, we just gave the Wednesday night to talking about the significance of the Lord's Day. God himself designated one day in seven as blessed and sanctified and set apart. That day was Saturday, and Jews still observe Saturday as the Sabbath. The New Testament church, without apparently a conscious decision, in other words, there's not a verse that says, at this moment in time, under these circumstances, the church transitioned to meeting on Sunday, but it did. And we'll talk again about that a little bit this evening. It will pertain to some of what we do. What I want to do this evening is just very, very, very superficially, because that's really about all the attention that we can give to it, talk about the things that we do on a typical standard Sunday. It's hard for many people, not all people, but it is hard for many people to envision a Sunday, a church service that doesn't constitute a Sunday school class by grades, some grade division, classes for different ages, a morning service, and an evening service. And when people come, there are things that they would expect to find. A choir, congregational singing, a nursery, an offering, of course, a sermon, some form of invitation. I remember one of my favorite stories, to me, maybe not to you, but this was many years ago. I got a call on Sunday morning from a man who was in the area visiting and was looking for a church to attend, wondering if we had a bus ministry. And at that time, we were running a van. I said, "We're not running a bus, we're running a van." He said, No, I want to go someplace that has big yellow buses. And I remember back in the mid-90s, and it was about the mid-90s, we had put that addition on where the basement is in 1993, 1994, and that was the fellowship hall. So I'm guessing that some of you have probably never really been in the basement. But that was the church fellowship hall, and we were going to undertake at that time what was the incredibly novel, new, radical, and highly contemporary practice of having donuts. And a godly man, he's still alive, he's now in his 90s, that I really respect and admire, told me, "Brother Largent, I don't think you should do that. I don't think you should do donuts on Sunday morning. I think that it will be detrimental to the ministry." So when we do this, whatever it is that happens on a Sunday, our consciences are either comfortable because we find what we expect, or they are disturbed because we do not find what we expect. If you came to church Sunday, August 27th, and on the platform was a large set of snare drums, we would not be having a biblical conversation, we'd be having a conscience conversation. And we would be having it. You know it, and I do too. So, at this point in time, I wish to make what now I hope is becoming my standard disclaimer. I have no subversive agenda. I'm not eliminating anything, altering anything, radicalizing anything. I'm not trying to lay the groundwork for anything. I just want us to be able to understand what the Bible does require, to recognize that different cultures, and we're going to focus on ours, take those commands and utilize them in different ways. And in the spirit and light of Romans 14, not condemning our brother for failing to do something exactly the way we do it when the issue is that of our human conscience. I think if we would be honest, we would have to admit that we're inclined to allow our traditions to take on biblical proportions. So that if I came to you, and again, this is purely hypothetical, if I came to you and said, "We're going to eliminate Sunday school," we would have lots of conversations about the merits of that. But the reality, folks, is we would have very few conversations about the biblical necessity to have Sunday school, because there is not one. So our consciences are huge. Are people truly unfaithful to God, for instance, if they do not attend Sunday night service or attend a church that has a Sunday night service? And I realize that I'm saying this on Wednesday night, and I have taken to trying to find opportunities to say it on Sunday morning. Having said that, Westwood Heights is a Sunday morning, Sunday night, Wednesday night church. There is no plan to change that. And the reality is that people who do not do that regularly and faithfully, I'm not saying there's disharmony or disunity, they're just a little out of sync with what goes on in the rest of the ministry. And certainly we pull leadership from folks who are Sunday morning, Sunday night, and Wednesday night people. But that still leads us to raise the question, how does the Lord think about that? Could somebody be faithful and not attend an evening service? So let's just start here. We've got the text open to Acts chapter 2. I would argue that the day of Pentecost is the inauguration of the New Testament church. I don't want to get into all the ecclesiology of that this evening, but that would be my understanding of it. What were these people doing? Let's just begin there. What did they do? Acts 2:42 tells us they continued steadfastly in the apostles' doctrine. There's obviously some form of teaching. The apostles are teaching doctrine. And people are continuing diligently in it. And fellowship. There is a definite sense of community. And what that means and how that plays out is really unclear here. I recently read a book that was given to me, and I was asked to read it and comment upon it, called, I think if I recall the name, it was Total Church. And I told the guy who recommended it, I said, I think he's put his finger on the problem. There are two guys who wrote the book. I think they put their finger on a very real problem. I'm just not sure that they're providing very biblically right solutions. How does a church maintain, how does it develop a sense of community? What do you have to do to have that? There obviously is one here. I think that's the point, the fellowship there, that which was held in common. There is the breaking of bread in Acts 2:42, which almost certainly is a reference to communion. In 1 Corinthians 11, Paul seems to allude to the fact that the church, at least the church at Corinth, practiced communion followed by a common meal. And that's where the overlap is and where the dilemma seems to be. And so Paul's advice was to eat your common meal at home, which raises another one of those issues. When I was a freshman at Midwestern Baptist Bible College in Pontiac, Michigan, and a very, very, very young Christian, and I only say that because I had not grown up in anything, and I did not know any of the controversies or the denominations or the peculiarities. One of the teachers that I had was adamant that food should never be served in a church building on the basis of 1 Corinthians 11. When Paul said, don't you have homes to eat in, that was the end of it. The only food served in a church, according to him, was the Lord's Supper, and everything else should be eaten at home. And this guy was a Baptist, by the way, I would point out, if you have any wonders about that. And then finally, in verse number 42, prayers. This is what they did. And I would argue that just as the core of the gospel is the death and resurrection of Christ, so the core of a church is these four things: doctrine, fellowship, communion, praying. How that plays out, we have some cues from Scripture, and we bring a lot of culture to that. When did they do this? When did they meet for doctrine, fellowship, Lord's Supper, and prayers? Acts 2:46, they continuing daily. Daily. Now, one of the things that is absent in this passage, excuse me, is any clear form of organizational structure. How did they do that? What came first? Apostles' doctrine, fellowship, Lord's Supper, prayer? Did it always go the same way? Did they always follow the same format? You'll notice that there's no offering, but you'll also notice, if you read on into Acts chapter 4, that people were just bringing money. That the practice wasn't for the apostles to say, it's time in the worship service where we're going to worship the Lord and taking the offering, but that they were regularly dealing with people bringing them things. Did the men and the women sit together? When I was in India, men and women sat on other sides, opposite sides of the auditorium. In America, some people are adamant that church should be a family thing. And we actually, I don't want to get too far ahead of myself, but some people would not, by conviction, would not have children's church, would not have nurseries, would insist that all families all sit together, mom, dad, kids, teens, babies, sit with your family. In India, men sat on one side, women sat on the other. And everybody sat on the floor except for the very elderly and infirm, and there were chairs at the back of the auditorium for them. In other words, God is telling us what happened, and he's telling us when it happened. What God is not telling us in Acts 2 is how it happened. What were the methodologies employed to accommodate thousands of people? And this raises, I guess, at least in my mind, one of the more interesting questions about the book of Acts, and that is, to what extent is it normative for a church? In other words, what should we duplicate and what should we learn from the book of Acts? Certainly sound doctrine and preaching and teaching are critical concepts in the New Testament. Certainly, prayer is a critical New Testament concept. Paul not only taught it, he requested it. Certainly, fellowship. Now, exactly what nature that is, but a common sense of belonging, a common sense of unity, a commonality among us. Does this require that we attempt to mandate the pattern of Acts where we're all living in proximity to each other, close proximity to each other? I don't think so. But we spent some time working through the one another passages. By virtue of being constituted the Lord's people, we have mutual obligations to each other, folks. And one of the great pitfalls of an American being a Christian is that they do not do well under that kind of instruction. We tend to want to be a collection of free spirits who don't have to answer to anybody or really think about anybody, to come and go as we please at our convenience, and we're happy to assemble in the same building, just don't make a big deal out of it. That really is not what the New Testament church teaches at all about what a New Testament church is, but that is the way we tend to do it and take great offense at the notion that I would ever have any responsibility towards anybody that would ever inconvenience me at any level for their benefit. Certainly the Lord's Supper is a critical component of the work, of what goes on. But if we're going to argue that Acts is normative, then any conversation about whether we should have a Sunday night service or a midweek service becomes academic, because if we're not having daily services, we're not right. So how do we respond to that? How do we resolve that issue? Well, there are a couple of pragmatic elements to this. One of the things you have to remember, folks, about the church that emerged at Pentecost is that its primary membership was visitors. And I don't mean that they didn't join the church, because I think the book of Acts kind of lends itself, when you get into, I think it's Acts 5, maybe Acts 4, In one of the ways that they talk about the number, there's a bit of a technicality there. It's not just that the Holy Spirit knew that there were 5,000 men, but that the church knew there were 5,000 men. They had enrolled those people into membership. But remember what happened. We have this pilgrimage festival that all Jews come to every year. And it is at that moment, in that venue, Pentecost, this great feast, that God begins to save thousands of souls. And they gravitate together and they come together. They did not all ultimately stay. And in fact, Acts chapter 8, part of the consequence of the persecution that came was that they went back to their homes. And the text seems to infer that's probably where they should have been in the first place. rather than enlarging the Baptist Church of Jerusalem, God was in quest of many smaller congregations elsewhere. But jump ahead, if you would, to Acts chapter 20. Because just to talk about history and context do not really provide us with the answer. Why are we at one level adamant that we must have a Wednesday night and a Sunday night service, and not at any level adamant that we have to have daily church services? And by the way, if you should leave here concluding that we need to have daily church services, we need an additional pastor. I'm not saying you need a replacement pastor, but we certainly need an additional pastor. I have too many soap operas to catch up on to prepare messages for seven times a week. Acts chapter 20. Now, we've advanced a number of years, and Paul has become saved, and he's off doing his evangelistic work. First, let's start in verse number 6. We sailed away from Philippi after the days of unleavened bread, and came unto them to Troas in 5 days, where we abode 7 days. And upon the first day of the week, when the disciples came together to break bread. Now, let's just stop right there. Certainly, Acts is not the norm for a New Testament church in the frequency of its meetings. Because by the time this many years have transpired, we're still in the apostolic era. Peter is alive, Paul is alive, many of the apostles are alive. It has now become the habit to meet on the first day of the week. Not every day, but the first day. In 1 Corinthians 16, 1 and 2, Paul suggests, and he's not talking about when they meet, he's talking about taking the offering, but he commands them to take the offering when they meet, which is the first day of the week, 1 Corinthians 16, 1 and 2. So the church meets in the New Testament one day a week, Sunday. There is no Wednesday night service that we're aware of, not in the New Testament. What does the church do? And I'm going to come back to Acts chapter 20 in a minute, but let me ask you to turn, if you would, to 1 Corinthians 14 for just a moment. The New Testament provides for us the instruction and the pattern that we meet on the first day of the week. What shall we do on the Lord's day, and how shall we do it? And so I want to start with one thing right straight out of the gate. Okay? I'm just going to dive right in, jump in the middle of Paul's conversation in verse number 26. How is it then, brethren, when ye come together, every one of you hath a psalm, hath a doctrine, hath a tongue, hath a revelation, hath an interpretation. Let all things be done unto edifying. If any man speak in an unknown tongue, let it be by two, or at the most by three, and that by course, and let one interpret. But if there be no interpreter, let him keep silence in the church, and let him speak to himself and to God. Let the prophet speak two or three, and let the other judge. If anything be revealed to another that sitteth by, let the first hold his peace. For ye may all prophesy one by one, that all may learn and all may be comforted. And the spirits of the prophets are subject to the prophets, which just means that whatever you're going to say in the New Testament, you better be able to substantiate it from the Old Testament. And that's true, by the way, of everything in the New Testament. The New Testament is constantly quoting the Old Testament. Verse number 33, why is this? For God is not the author of confusion, but of peace, as in all churches of the saints. Let your women keep silence in the churches, for it is not permitted unto them to speak, but they are commanded to be under obedience, as also saith the law. And if they will learn anything, let them ask their husbands at home, for it is a shame for women to speak in the church. What? Came the word of God out from you, or came it unto you only? If any man think himself to be a prophet or spiritual, let him acknowledge that the things that I write unto you are the commandments of the Lord. But if any man be ignorant, let him be ignorant. Wherefore, brethren, covet to prophesy, and forbid not to speak with tongues. Let all things be done decently and in order. Now, one of the questions that's raised by the book of Acts is whether or not speaking in tongues is the norm and accept. And we, of course, would reject that concept, and that's a whole other conversation. I'm not going to go in there. What does Paul mean when he talks about all things done decently in order? Well, he's referring to what happens when the church comes together. And what apparently is going on in Corinth is some kind of a free-for-all in the name of God, where everybody has a song that God gave them, a new doctrine that God gave them. The women and the men are participating equally in that, which is not permitted. And Paul establishes some guidelines. And so if somebody has a song, and somebody has a doctrine, and somebody has a tongue, and you can just imagine, in light of everything else we know about the Corinthians, that there are escalating tensions as people clamor to be heard, and there are unkind words and disparaging remarks. Let everything be done decently and in order. This isn't Robert's Rules of Order, which I realize some Baptists hold right up there with Moses. decently is translated honestly in Romans 13:13 and 1 Thessalonians 12. It actually comes from a word referring to the shape of something. Something that was well proportioned, that was beautiful in appearance, was honest or decent. So a church service should have a decent shape. And the words "in order," let all things be done decently and in order, that comes from, in English we have a word that we use, the word taxonomy. Taxonomy refers to the way things are classified. The classification of things is the discipline of taxonomy. That is the root word here, the basic concept of in order. So to carry it over to us, because there are some people, and within denominations, the Society of Friends, or people more commonly called Quakers, were champions of this, that a church service should by design not be chaos, but be disorganized, that it comes with no agenda, no plan, no structure, and will wait for God to move. Because there are some people who believe that spontaneity is more godly. But the reality, folks, is God has never been spontaneous. God is sovereign and eternal and has decreed the end of all things from the time that He decreed them from the beginning, and all things happen from the foundation of the world. Spontaneity is not compatible with that. The fact that something happens now, we go, whoa, who was expecting that, does not make God spontaneous. It makes me recognize my humanity. I don't know everything. I'm not in the inner circles of God's counsel. It is not a hallmark of spirituality that a church comes together and nobody knows what's going to happen until the Spirit moves. Do it decently and in order. Arrange things. Those who can minister musically should be those who minister musically. Those who can teach and preach should be those who do teach and preach. Those who can minister in other ways should minister in those other ways. This is what is being argued there. And obviously, with reference to that, varying cultures have varying ways of doing things. But let's come back and talk about us. And we're going to come back now to Acts chapter 20 in just a moment. So here we are. It is a typical Sunday morning and at 10 o'clock, which when I came here in 1984, Sunday school was at 9:45, but I was a fast talker and a short speaker, and there was just too much time to contend with, so we moved it to 10 o'clock. The Sunday school movement really began in about 1780. There had been previous versions, but it began in earnest in about 1780. It is a cultural reaction to the Industrial Revolution. It began in England. In 1802, England passed a revolutionary law. It limited children to a 12-hour workday. Children could no longer legally be required to work more than 12 hours in a factory. 1802. Education is not compulsory. It is almost all done at home unless you are very rich, part of the nobility. Two men were heavily involved, men by the name of Thomas Stock and Robert Raikes. Raikes goes on to become known as the father of the Sunday school movement. They began by teaching children to read, and they did this mostly for boys. Right? We have all of these children working. They're not going to school. They're not at home. They're working. The textile industry began in earnest in England, making fabric on machines, turning cotton into fabric, into clothing. So they began to gather boys on Sunday, and the Bible was the textbook, and they began to teach them to read. Once they had learned to read, they went on to teach them catechism. And one of the more radical elements of the Sunday school movement was that the teachers were not trained ministers, but were lay people. And these Sunday schools oftentimes lasted much of the day. They went from 10 to noon, and then again from 1 to 5. So they were the length of a day. They were highly criticized when they began, although ultimately there were well over 1 million children attending English Sunday schools. They were criticized for violating the Sabbath. They were criticized because they made lay people work on Sunday. They were criticized because people believed that they would become tools of political propaganda. They were criticized because they believed that they were interfering with the responsibility of the parent to teach their child how to read. So what we take as 10 o'clock pastor teaches a lesson, let's be realistic, really began as what was viewed by many people as a culturally subversive movement. Now, does that mean we shouldn't do it? No. Okay, let's not let our head fall off and roll around the room. But let's not pretend that Jesus had Sunday school at 10, followed by a morning service at 11. Back to Acts chapter 20. What about that evening service? Acts chapter 20 and verse number 7. And upon the first day of the week, when the disciples came together to break bread, Paul preached unto them, ready to depart on the morrow, and continued his speech until midnight. What time did he start? We have no way of knowing. How long did he preach? What constitutes a long sermon to Paul? Some historians actually think that in the early days of the church, the norm was to meet at night. And one thing you have to remember, folks, in the early days of Christianity, not all, but many of the converts were slaves. And the Romans were not a Christianized people. They didn't view one day in seven as sanctified or set apart. They had their own holidays that they treasured, but every day was a work day. If a pagan owned you, the likelihood that he's going to cut you loose on a Sunday so you can go to church is pretty small. So you're either going to have to draw that line in the sand, or you're going to have to take a pragmatic approach to meet when the workday ended. And it appears that what the early church really did was take the pragmatic approach and meet when the workday ended. Somewhere between 100 and 200 AD, the Romans began to crack down on Christians, but particularly they cracked down on any meeting that they thought would be seditious, that would be against the Roman government. And the church was kind of driven to meeting in secret. And it was about that time that they began to meet very early in the morning. And we have records from a man by the name of Pliny, who was in Ephesus, who was writing back to the emperor about his interaction with the Christians, how that they met before the break of day and they sang hymns and they broke bread together and they talked about the Bible. And then it was off to, probably for many of them, just another day at work. Now, should we embrace that model? No. But neither should we develop the mentality that if Sunday at 11 o'clock was good enough for Paul, it's good enough for us. The evening and the week and the midweek services really in many ways go right back to the Protestant Reformation, and the Puritans brought that to America, and they based it upon a biblical fact, and that's not a bad thing. We just have to be careful about finding something from the Bible and turning it into a command. You can look at it in Exodus 29 or Numbers 28 that there was a morning and an evening sacrifice. There was a morning and an evening sacrifice, and they said there should be a morning and an evening service. And again, I have no agenda. I'm not trying to get out of anything. And I say this, and I'm not saying it to be funny. I'm saying it to be deadly earnest, right? You might think, I have a lot to gain if we didn't have a Sunday night service, but nobody has more to gain than I do. I don't have to come to church Sunday night, and I don't have to spend the better part of a day getting ready to preach on Sunday night. So, I'm just talking to us. There's no agenda here. I am all for Sunday night services. I believe they're great. I was listening to a guy. I've read some of his commentaries. He's one of those guys I'd much rather read him than hear him preach. I don't know if I can explain that to you. And he lamented after 35 years in the ministry that he hadn't been able to preach through all the books in the Bible. And I just thought to myself, well, you could have if you had a church that had Sunday morning, Sunday night, and Wednesday night services. But no, not in 35 years of Sunday mornings, you're not going to get through all 66 books of the Bible. But some churches, folks, have never, ever had them. They just never, ever have. And others have stopped. And I guess what really concerns me is, you know, it's not having. One of the things I love about Westwood Heights is not that we have a Sunday night service, it's that when we have one, we never have to apologize for it. I mean, I've had conversations with pastors who have said to me, what do you do to get people to come back to church on Sunday night? I can't get anybody to come back to church on Sunday. That's the problem. There's where the problem is. And if we filled the building on Sunday night with people who sat there stone-faced and wouldn't sing and didn't want to be there, have we really done anything? My goal is that we think rightly about it. It's a wonderful thing. It is a reflection. And I think both starting one and stopping one is a reflection of the way that you think about things spiritually. But thinking about things spiritually right is the real goal, not trying to support it with a structure that men have made. Well, so we have Sunday school and we have midweek services. In the midweek services, their history is even harder. Some people take them back to the American Revolution when George Washington called for a day of prayer and fasting. Many times he began his prayer meetings and they kind of turned into Bible studies, which, you know, we have 2 minutes of prayer and 45 minutes of Bible study. That's what we do. Some people don't do that. It's all prayer, and some people have used the time for visitation. What about the things that we do, okay? I mean, we have Sunday morning 10. We recognize the history. We have a morning service. We recognize the biblical mandate to assemble together. We have an evening service. We have a midweek service. Certainly, the Bible mandates that we sing to each other. And we say, what can I do for, what can I, what ministry can I be involved in? Well, here's one, and I'm not trying to be funny because it's not funny. The ministry of singing to your fellow saints. Ephesians 5. That's real ministry. Well, it doesn't feel like real ministry, but it doesn't have to feel like real ministry if God calls it real ministry. Singing to yourselves in psalms and hymns and spiritual songs. It's not singing under your breath to yourself in the shower. That's singing to each other. We have a choir, but you can't find a choir in the New Testament. You have to go back to the Old Testament. You can't even really find a choir in the Old Testament until you go to the book of Chronicles, which you're given all the details of David's choir. No New Testament basis? Again, this is not a shot across the bow that the choir is going anywhere. But some people don't have choirs because they say choirs are performances. And that the only biblically accepted way of singing is for the congregation to sing to itself, to each other. And that to put some people up in front and have them sing is to have them perform. What about nurseries? Nurseries are pragmatic. I know of guys who will not have a nursery. I come from a background, and those of you that went to the same school that I did know that this is true. If there was a baby crying in the auditorium, Jack Hiles stopped the service, no matter where it was in the service. Stop, screech, put on the brakes, slam on the brakes, take the baby out, please. Take the baby out. And we didn't, nobody went anywhere, nothing stopped, happened until the baby left. There were thousands of people in that auditorium. And if that happened every service, then he did it every service. Nurseries are pragmatic. I'm glad for a nursery, but are we going to offend God if we didn't have one? Some people would argue that we offend God if we do, but I think they're kooks too. What about things like children's church and graded Sunday school classes? Lee Robertson pastored Highland Park Baptist Church in Chattanooga, Tennessee for, I don't know, 30 years, 40 years. Never had children's church. Argued that the Bible didn't call for children's church. And he's absolutely right, but the Bible doesn't call for suits and ties either. But Lee Robertson was famous for wearing a black double-breasted suit. That was what he wore. Some people, some churches, don't like the ideas of families sitting together or sitting separated. I mean, there are churches, folks, where if you let the teens sit with their friends, that is, you know, there's heresy, denying God, and letting your children sit with somebody else besides you. What about something like the school? And I know churches, in fact, I was, and I hope I'm not, I didn't run this by them, but I was talking with my daughter, my middle daughter, and son-in-law, and they go to a conservative church, but not as conservative as us in Fremont. And we were talking about children's church. And they don't have one. And they have a lot of kids. And they were talking about the distraction. And then she said, but one of the problems that we have is problem getting workers, because our church has a mandate that we will not be highly organized and have a lot of programs. Well, I can understand that, because programs can get out of hand. But all that, what about the school? So what about the school? And I just want to stop here. This has really nothing to do with tonight. But the last time I talked to you at length about the school, within a short amount of time, I was fielding questions from people who are not members of Westwood Heights about closing the school. I hear you're closing the school. And since I was the guy doing the talking, I just find that fascinating that somebody, okay, I'm not trying to be unkind to any of you, but I talked to you about the school and what I saw the future of the school being, and you talked to somebody, and they came back to me and said, I hear you're closing the school. So can I just make two observations about that? Number one, there are no plans to close the school. Number two, bigger issue, I don't close school. You close school. Whether or not we have a school is a Westwood Heights decision, not a Ken Largent decision. Observation number three, if I can add, if you really want to have the question, and this would be my assessment, the answer to how long OBA will last really is more in the hands of these younger couples who are just approaching family stage. Do they want a school? What about a school? School is a pragmatic decision, and I know people who would argue that they are totally outside the realm of anything that a church should do. I know of a guy whose conviction would be that he would never have a school, and of course we have a school and we run in circles with people's schools, and I've heard guys preach that they have a conviction, heard a guy say, I would never pastor a church that didn't have a school. And then I know a guy said, I would never pastor a church that did. So when you get clarity on that, I am always willing to be instructed. What about things like bus ministries? I come from a big bus ministry church. And I would just point out to you folks that there is no such thing anywhere in the New Testament, front to back, beginning to end, in which the church has ever been commanded to or even expected to go out and bring a bunch of lost people in so they can hear the gospel. It is supposed to take the gospel to lost people, not bring lost people into the building to hear it and call that a church. I have gotten a little cranky on that. I'm not opposed to us having a bus ministry, but I'm just, a church, by definition, is a local assembly of baptized believers meeting together to fulfill the Great Commission. Lost people cannot be a part of the church. They can be in the church building, but they can never be a part of the church. They're not a part of the body. So that, to me, is not a matter of conscience. That becomes a matter of conviction. Okay, I'm just going to try and wrap this up. Like I said, this has been a superficial, and we would have to do extensive church history, and you probably have no interest, and I promise you I have no interest in doing that. Whatever we do, folks, okay, whatever programs we have, right, we have a biblical mandate to meet on the Lord's Day. We are obligated to pray. We're obligated to take the Lord's Supper. We're obligated to be involved in each other's lives in genuine fellowship ways, which sometimes means having serious conversations about things that are lacking and serious conversations about other things, and sometimes means social occasions. And we are to have some expression of doctrine. For us, that's me preaching a sermon or somebody teaching a Sunday school class. Those are non-negotiables. The goal is that everything else we do is the outflow of a genuine spiritual interest. I don't want us to have any program simply because churches like ours have them. If there's nobody to participate, if there's nobody to be involved, if there's no spirit on the part of the church to have it, then we should just take that as it's not for us, not now, and we'll deal with our consciences. We haven't disappointed the Lord in doing those things.